Let me try and begin where I left off last time. Before I begin, do any of you have any questions about the course or anything like that? What are we trying to do in this part of the course? We're trying to get insight into these great issues that lie at the heart of the field of international relations. The whole question of what makes for war and what makes for a stable international system. And the Cold War is of great interest from the point of view of both of those questions. You know, what was generating this conflict? And I stressed how when you look at these things through a theoretical lens, the Cold War is profoundly puzzling. Saying, well, wasn't it obvious that the status quo for both sides was vastly preferable to a Third World War, above all in the nuclear age? And if that's the case, where's the problem, right? So that way of looking at it defined what we needed to look for, you know? The one great exception to this basic rule about how the two sides could live with each other, namely the German question. Because the Soviets couldn't just sit on their hands while the West moved ahead with the building up of German power. And yet didn't the West have to move in that direction, if only for purely defensive reasons? You know, it's like you take action that you know the other side is going to find threatening, even though you're doing it for purely defensive reasons. That's the basic concept of the security dilemma, a very fundamental idea that developed within political science to kind of get at the issue of how you could have a war, how you could have international tension, even if no one really wants it. And that issue is of absolutely fundamental importance in the nuclear age. No one wants a nuclear war. Nevertheless, people are worried about it happening. How could it possibly happen if no one wants it? Well, this is kind of an answer. You take these actions for essentially defensive purposes. The West had to kind of ease up on the constraints that were keeping the Germans down. The West had to get the Germans to voluntarily become part of the Western defense system. The West had to, you know, suggest to the Germans that they that the German national goals are basically supported by the Western powers, and all these things the Soviets were bound to view as threatening. So, if the German question is like at the heart of the Cold War, it follows from that if you want to understand how a stable system, a peaceful order, eventually did come into being during the Cold War years, and it did in the later Cold War, you have to focus on that political issue. You know, how the German question was resolved. It didn't. A peaceful system did not come into being because of nuclear weapons. If that had been the case, you would have had a peaceful system much, much earlier than you did. German question is of fundamental importance. So we're looking, therefore, at how the German question was dealt with. And let me remind you again about how this whole part of the course is being structured. We're looking at these occasions, and there are four of them, when it seemed that a peaceful settlement was within reach, that the two sides had reached an accommodation on these basic issues having to do with Germany. First, 1945. Division of Europe, the whole Potsdam Understanding between Burns and Stalin. You run things in your part of Germany, we'll run things in our part of Germany. Implicitly, you run things in your part of Europe, we'll run things in our part of Europe. We could live with each other on that basis. Right? It seemed that a peaceful solution was at hand. It failed. How do we know it failed? Because by 1946, the two sides were screaming at each other about about how awful each other was. So what went wrong? See, you bring the question to focus, and you can understand it in terms of what was going on in Soviet's southern border with Turkey and Iran in 1946, and how that triggered a set of responses that led the American government to realize that it couldn't hope for a kind of friendly, peaceful division of Europe into spheres of influence, but that it had to mobilize the power of the West. And to do that, it had to kind of portray the Soviets as it's much worse than they actually were. Right? They cheated on their agreements. They don't live up to their promises. We had hoped that they would allow a free Eastern Europe to come into being after the war. They kind of reneged on that, and so on and so on and so on. Right? A line of argument which American leaders knew to be false, but adopted for instrumental purposes because the nature of our political system, this is a problem that Kennan was pointing to. Nature of political system, you have to kind of bang the drums really hard to get the American people to do the minimum that they should be doing. You have to over-define the issues. And the famous phrase of Dean Acheson, very important in these matters, even in the early Truman administration, but it became Secretary of State in the second Truman administration in 1949 and stayed until 1953. Acheson said, we had to make things clearer than the truth. No question that was done for those tactical purposes. So the first attempt at a peaceful settlement really failed. Yeah? Acheson, Dean Acheson. Yeah? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Is what a result? Well, it doesn't. The 1945 thing doesn't work. They realize that a friendly arrangement doesn't work, and what this Turkey and Iran business showed was that these guys, this is what the Americans saw. The only thing they respect is force. You have to have countervailing power. You have to have a balance of power, or else you're not going to have a stable system. How do you have a balance of power? You got to get your own people to realize that these issues about the fate of Europe are so important that they should be willing to go to war in the final analysis if their kind of core interests in that area are threatened. And to kind of mobilize American power, you have to mobilize American opinion by over-defining the threat. And in a sense, you have to kind of ask yourself, do you criticize them for doing that? Same thing about Roosevelt in 1941. Do you criticize him for pursuing the policy he did? Well, if it was the only way to reach the desired end, in other words, preventing all of Europe with this massive war-making resources from falling under the control of a single hostile power, whether you're talking about 1941 or the Cold War period, and this is the only choice they have because of the nature of our political system, well, can you blame them? Or do you blame the democratic political system that we have in our country? And, and Kennan raises this issue at the end of that article. If that's the case, if it's our own democratic norms and values and structures and so on that are the heart of the problem, we better think about that issue and figure out how to manage it. Right? This is an important problem that more serious people in the United States were concerned with throughout the Cold War period and, in fact, beyond. Okay? That's the first chance for peace, and we saw how it failed. But then we also looked at the second chance for peace. This was the 1949 business. You have the crisis coming to a head in 1948 with a decision to create a West German state, the Soviet response, which is the Berlin blockade, the West realizing it needs to create a formal security organization to deal with this more threatening Soviet policy and to reassure the West Europeans. And that process runs its course along these three interrelated tracks in the 48-49 period, decision to construct a West German state. That state comes into being in the spring of 49. Soviet response, Berlin blockade, which runs its course, and the blockade is lifted also in the spring of 1949, and the decision to create a Western defense system, the North Atlantic Treaty, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, also decided upon in the Washington Treaty in the spring of 1949. So by the spring of 1949, you think, well, the whole process has run its course. The West had constructed its system. The Soviets, by deciding to end the Berlin blockade, had agreed to accept it. But it doesn't work. How do we know it doesn't work? Because the very next year, the world goes into this really serious crisis. So people think that a third world war, you know, this is like December of 1950, January 51. People think that a third world war might be, you know, just weeks away. We're learning all these things about from Eastern European sources about how the Soviets are getting ready for war. There are all these material indicators of how the Soviets are getting ready for war. We know now, Stalin tells Mao in November of 1950, you know, if war is inevitable, let it happen now. And what was the problem there? There was no real political understanding that had been reached in 1949. The Soviets were still not happy with what was going on in Germany, still worried about it. But they had to put their concerns on hold because they were too weak at that particular point to bring matters to a head. Right? They were too weak because they did not have any nuclear weapons. The United States did not have a large military force in being in Europe. The American demobilization after World War II had been quite extraordinary. Basically, the whole military machine that had been constructed during the war was thrown on the junk heap in a matter of months. And the Americans felt, well, they didn't have to spend all that much money on for military purposes. They had a nuclear monopoly. They had this huge industrial plant. The United States is at the peak of its industrial power vis-a-vis the rest of the world at the end of World War II, because, you know, half of world industrial production was accounted for by the United States, a figure that was higher than it ever had been in the past and was higher than it ever would be in the future. Right? Fully half. This is quite extraordinary. If a war did break out, well, yeah, there would be reverses at the beginning of the war, but there could be no doubt about what the outcome of the war would be, because the United States would simply gear up and destroy the adversary with bombs and bombers and other sorts of military forces that were generated after the outbreak of the war. But it would be a Pyrrhic victory, because you would be liberating corpses in Western Europe. All of our friends in Western Europe, especially the educated classes there, would have been, you know, annihilated by during the initial part of the war through the Soviet conquest of Western Europe. So there's no willingness on the part of the American military authorities or the political leadership to pursue a tough line vis-a-vis the Soviets in the late 1940s. You know, very cautious on not just on matters related to the Berlin blockade and so on, but on all kinds of other issues, the intervention in places like Greece or Italy, very leery of that sort of thing, you know, defending even our side of the line of demarcation through military force. We just didn't have enough of force and being to take a really tough line. The Soviets obviously didn't want to bring matters to a head either, because although they would have these initial victories, in the final analysis they would be utterly destroyed. Everyone knew these things. So it was a balance, but it was a precarious balance, and the only thing that maintained that balance was the American nuclear monopoly. As soon as the nuclear monopoly was broken, matters were bound to deteriorate very dramatically for the West. Right? If the answer to the question of why all of these issues were put on hold in the spring of 1949 has to do with what's going on in the military sphere, so the dramatic change in the military sphere resulting from the breaking of the American nuclear monopoly by the Soviets on August 29, 1949, this was bound to have far-reaching consequences. All this was understood at the time. People expected that there would be an upsurge in Soviet aggressiveness, And the event that came in the Far East with the North Korean attack on the South in June of 1950, followed in November of 1950 by something that was much more serious, the Chinese communist intervention in the war. Chinese communists had just come to power in China the previous year, in 1949. Now in 1950, they were taking on the world's strongest power in terms of its mobilizable war potential, pushing it not just out of North Korea, but threatening to kind of kick the Americans out of the entire Korean Peninsula. I mean, this was a dramatic thing, and it can only be understood in terms of Stalin's sense that maybe now would be the time to kind of settle things with the West before it was too late. And that sense that the Soviets had a momentary edge over the United States that was not going to last meant that Stalin, during this period, was poised on the brink of a war with the West over these European questions, especially over the question of Germany. Right? So, the problem was actually made more serious, by, at least in the short run, by the measures the American government took to remedy all of the defects in the Western military posture that had been revealed by these events. A massive, utterly massive rearmament program was adopted in late 1950. Key document here was NSC 68/4. This is not the famous NSC 68 document. You don't have to know this. I'm not going to ask you about this. But the key thing is to realize that the Americans decide on a massive rearmament effort in December of 1950. And since we're in the middle of a technological revolution in the military sphere, especially with regard to nuclear weapons, the development of the hydrogen bomb, the improvements in the design of nuclear weapons so that they can be made light enough to be carried by fighter bombers, by bombers based on aircraft carriers, and so on. This utterly transformed the strategic situation. Soviets had no chance of standing up to the Americans because the Soviet economy had been utterly devastated by the war, right? And the great American edge was in technology, especially, and they were really capitalizing on their technological advantages. But since the new technology meant that factories had to be basically a lot of them kind of re-equipped from scratch. It took a long time for the investment in new weaponry to become effective in terms of military end products, for these new weapons to be deployed to the forces that were capable of using them, right? But given that the military balance was shifting so dramatically in that way, and the Soviets could see what was going on, this gave them even more of an incentive to act, right? Sooner rather than later. If war is inevitable, why should they wait? Why should they wait until the Americans have built up their military power? You know, it was better to have it now than later. You know, those kind of preventive war ideas, which we saw, you know, the earlier periods that we've covered in this course, were quite important. And the Americans were aware of the fact that the decision to move ahead with a dramatic military buildup was going to have this consequence, but they decided they would run the risk. Right? Not only that, but the Americans also decided to move ahead in terms of building up ground forces in Europe. The American forces that were sent over to Europe in 1951, 6 divisions. You know, this would be the backbone of a impressive Western force that would be capable of balancing Soviet power in Europe. Right? the backbone of a Western force, but it was just the backbone. The force as a whole would have to be filled out by military forces raised by the European powers. Not just by the British and the French, but also by the West Germans. It was taken for granted that you needed German troops if you were going to have a viable defense system in Western Europe. Okay? But once you're talking about the rearmament of Germany, that's the fundamental raw nerve of the Soviets. That's what they're scared about. Right? A strong West Germany. It's a West Germany that's not locked into a purely defensive policy. It's a West Germany that's capable of using its military power to achieve its political goals. And its fundamental political goal is the reunification of Germany. A strong, unified German state capable of defending itself. That's the last thing the Soviets want. You know, could lead to the loss of their East European empire, could lead to a new world war, last thing that they want. And so these attempts on the part of the Americans, most notably at the New York Conference in September of 1950, to get the Europeans to move in that direction, to accept the rearmament of Germany as a condition for American willingness to defend Western Europe on the ground, right? Those attempts on the part of the Americans were quite dangerous. They could have triggered a Third World War. The Soviets were poised on the brink as it was. And this could tip the balance, it was felt. And so the Europeans, they were very leery of this American pressure to move in that direction. They understood, even the French understood, that ultimately German power would have to be integrated in the Western defense system, but in such a way that West Germany would pose no threat, right? Because the threat to the Soviets could trigger a war that would be a threat to all of Europe. It's the last thing that they wanted. They didn't want a strong, independent West Germany. So, but how could you get the Americans to move ahead with the defense of Western Europe without agreeing to the American condition that the Europeans would have to accept German rearming? Well, the answer was, you don't want to oppose them directly, outright. What you want to do is, drag your feet, bring up all kinds of problems, propose alternate ways of doing it, one of which was called the Pleven Plan. It's not an important thing, you don't have to remember this, but this is an idea that was proposed by the French in December of 1950 to kind of slow the Americans down. There's a plan for a European army composed basically of French and German troops, but it's single uniform, single command structure, and so on. It would prevent the Germans from acting independently, and so on. This American pressure on the Europeans, by the way, had an important political consequence. It's like it led the continental West Europeans, French in particular, to start rubbing their eyes and saying, gee, we have common strategic interests vis-a-vis both the Soviets and the Americans. We should kind of come together as a political bloc so that we could create enough weight to kind of slow the Americans down and make the Americans take account of our interest in avoiding a new war. We want Western Europe to be defended, but we don't want the Soviets to be provoked. So we should kind of come together. You know, the European integration, the building of a European bloc, meaning continental West European bloc, based on France and Germany, with the Benelux countries and with Italy attached. You know, this is coming to appeal not just to people in Germany, but also to people in France, especially, because this is the only way that Europe could have some political weight in the world, could be more than just an American protectorate and make sure that the West pursued a policy that took due account of European interests. So the policy of building Europe, as it was called, had an anti-American edge from the start. But the Americans loved the idea of the Europeans coming together. Because what it meant for the Americans was, if they came together, then they could stand on their own. They have the resources if they could put all their silly national feelings aside. They had the resources to generate enough power that could serve as an effective counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. They could defend themselves. So even though this policy had an anti-American edge, the Americans liked all of this stuff. What this meant was that there were going to be all these complicated negotiations about the form of German rearmament. You know, would it be on a national basis? Would it be on an Atlantic basis, that is to say, within the NATO structure? Would it be in which the Americans would play a central role? Would it be on a European basis, basically some sort of European defense community, European army, not under American control, where ultimately the Europeans would generate enough force to defend themselves, but Germany would not be able to act independently? What sort of military structure should you have? There was that set of issues. And you couldn't have a NATO army and German armament of any sort unless you regulated political relations between Germany and the West. Yes, the Federal Republic had come into being, but the Federal Republic was still an occupied state. The occupation was still in existence. Military government ended in 1949 with the establishment of the Federal Republic, but there was something called the Occupation Statute that limited what the Germans could do, and German decisions could be reversed by the representatives of the Allied powers. They were called High Commissioners, not even ambassadors at that point. Okay? There's a very nice book in German on this period. It's called, translation would be, The Occupied Ally. West Germany is kind of an ally of the West, but it's still under military occupation until 1955. You have to work out what sort of political status Germany would have. No, you know, not total freedom for Germany, because then you would have all these dangers of a Germany playing between East and West, the sort of dangers that people remembered from the Weimar period in the 1920s. You didn't want that. But Germany couldn't be run as a colony forever, as an occupied state. Germany would have to recover more of her political rights, but not full sovereignty. There have to be limits, and these limits were kind of connected to how much freedom of action Germany would have in the military sphere. So they had all these kind of complex negotiations. What did the Allied powers, what rights did they have? Did they have the right to station troops in Germany? If so, what were the rights of those troops? Could they be used without first getting the okay of the German government? Could they intervene in extreme cases in German internal affairs? All of these issues were enormously complex issues, and the they had all kinds of domestic political implications in all of the countries that were party to these talks, and especially in France, where any arrangement you worked out with the Germans for a European army would have to be on the basis of equality. If the German sovereignty, in terms of their ability to have a national army under the full control of the national political authorities, you know, if that was the arrangement for Germany, you have to do the same thing for France. But would France not be able to have control over its own military forces? You know, would France have to sacrifice its own sovereignty in order to work something like this out? How could you, how could you solve these problems in the way that they would be domestically palatable in France, in Germany, in all these other countries? Enormously complex issues. Negotiations went on for years. Probably in 1952, they reached agreement on a treaty setting up something called the European Defense Community, basically a European, continental West European army. You know, single uniform, single commander, and so on. But no clear sense for how the European army was to be run, who were the political authorities that were to be in charge of how it would be used. It was put under the command of the American NATO commanders, the SACEUR, because Europeans, the last thing they wanted was to create such a strong European system that the Americans feel that they could leave. The Germans didn't want the Americans to leave. The French didn't want the Americans to leave. The Americans wanted to leave, ultimately, and that's why they were so keen on European integration. Because if the Europeans could stand on their own, we wouldn't have to bother with defending these people. So it was the Europeans that were pushing toward this, toward a system based on a strong American military presence. All right, so this EDC business, then it has to be ratified. The EDC was based on a French plan, this Pleven plan of December of 1950. Finally, you get its treaty, but there's no majority within the French Chamber of Deputies to ratify this thing. You know, this is the joke of the time was the French can't take yes for an answer. Of course, the whole point of the plan hadn't been to bring this thing into being. It had been to kind of sabotage what the Americans were doing in a way that the Americans wouldn't find too offensive. Right? And it wasn't until October of 1954 that the West constructs its own system. There's a system of the Paris Accords. Paris Accords, extremely important. This is the great settlement between the Western Paris and West Germany. What happened was everyone's getting fed up with the French. The French policy is in a total shambles. And finally, the French political class turns to this kind of maverick, Pierre Mendès France, who he becomes prime minister. And his job, and he said this, was to be like French foreign policy was bankrupt. It had been put into receivership, and he was the receiver. He was the one who was supposed to manage this bankrupt foreign policy and get France out of the mess. So what he does is he allows the EDC to go down to defeat in August of 1954, and then the Americans are furious about this. This is the Eisenhower administration coming to power in January of 53. It has its heart set on a freestanding Europe. And even though Eisenhower is a military man, thinks the EDC is ludicrous, American power is thrown into the balance to kind of get the Europeans to go along with this thing. We make all these threats to the Europeans. This is the famous agonizing reappraisal of Secretary of State Dulles in December of 53. If the Europeans don't agree to the EDC, we may well abandon them. Well, that was the implication there. The French and the British together, they basically take the lead now over the objections of the Americans in coming up with an alternative to the EDC system. This is a system based on a continuing American presence in Europe, right? Again, the Europeans want the NATO system. They want a system built on the Americans staying in. The Americans don't like that kind of thing. They want a system built on the Europeans providing for their own defense. Like, you have to bear this in mind, because a lot of people in the later Cold War and the post-Cold War period, they insist that NATO is an instrument of American domination. America is this great imperial power that wants to impose its control over other people, doesn't want other countries to be able to stand on their own two feet. You look at the whole history of this thing, it's exactly the reverse. All right. Why was it that the West was able to build a system of this sort? It had not been able to move ahead in September of 1950. The Europeans, the French, and especially the Germans, had been able to sabotage the Acheson policy of a rapid rearmament of Germany for fear of provoking a Soviet preventive attack. Okay? But as the West built up its power, as the American rearmament effort ran its course, the West had a free hand to do what it wants. The military side of the story is of fundamental importance. I put that little chart on the blackboard to kind of give you a very rough schematic sense for what was going on in the military sphere. Okay? Here in 1945, the United States has the upper hand. American industry intact, Soviet industry, largely devastated. We tear up the military machine, but in the late 1940s, 47 to August 49, it's a rough balance, because neither side wants to push things to the point of war. And the balance is broken when the Soviets explode their bomb. Right? It's unclear who would win a war. The United States, it was feared, might well lose a war. That's what General Bradley said in the National Security Council in November of 1950, if war broke out in 1950, for reasons I explained last time. So the balance shifts to favor the Soviets at this point. Then the Americans embark on their rearmament effort, slow at first, again for the reasons I explained, and then suddenly, as all the stuff starts, you know, the military end products start pouring off the assembly lines and are deployed to the forces in the field, the American military edge shoots up right before the end of the Truman period, you know, late 1952, right? And this is what gives the Americans the freedom, or the West in general, the freedom to move ahead in constructing its own political system. And the system that ultimately came into being is the system of the Paris Accords. Not imposed by the Americans. They accepted it with, you know, very poor grace, if you look at the documents. Okay. And what was the system of the Paris Accords? It's very important because the argument is that this is a third chance for peace. A third chance for peace. Yeah. Because it was something that, in principle, both the West Europeans, including the West Germans, and the Soviets could live with. Because it provided for a defense of Western Europe without posing a threat to the Soviets. Okay. What was the system of the Paris Accords? The whole series of agreements, I know there must have been like 20 agreements. That's why we say it's a system. On the military side, yes, a German army is going to come into being, an army with, you know, under German command with its own uniforms and so on. But there are limits on German military power. First of all, the entire German force is integrated into NATO. What does that mean? It's deployed in accordance with arrangements that are worked out by the NATO command. NATO command is basically, NATO is basically a planning organization, insofar as it has any institutional structure at all. NATO command will decide how, you know, come up with war plans and deploy national forces in accordance with an overall war plan. If forces are deployed in accordance with an overall war plan, they can't be used independently. Not just that, but German military operations in the event of a war in the NATO system will be dependent on a logistical system, on supply channels that ran through other countries, through the Benelux countries and through France. And so, given that it was an integrated logistical system, that was another limit on Germany's ability to function independently in the military sphere. The Germans might move away from that, but once they started moving away from that, that would be a powerful signal, you know, for other countries to take counteraction. If the Germans were only interested in defense, the NATO system could supply that. The Germans weren't under any compulsion to take actions that could pose threats to other countries for purely defensive purposes because the NATO system provided for their defense. See, all this stuff kind of solves the security dilemma. Okay? But the core constraint on German power was in the nuclear sphere. The Germans effectively weren't supposed to, you know, technically they weren't supposed to build nuclear weapons on their own territory. There was something called the Western European Union, which came into being. It still exists. It's not terribly important. But it provided for the exercise of controls on German military power, especially in the area of heavy weapons, unconventional weapons, nuclear weapons, and so on. The German Chancellor, Konrad Adenauer, made a declaration in late 1954 accepting these constraints. Germany had no intention of building nuclear weapons on its own territory. As long as Germany was non-nuclear, Germany could not possibly stand up to a great power armed with nuclear weapons like the USSR on its own. Germany, therefore, was dependent on the Western powers and, above all, on the United States for protection. And if Germany was dependent on them for protection, Germany was locked into the policy choices that they had made, a policy of living with the status quo of a divided Europe. America, Britain, and France happy to accept the division of Europe. Germans not so, but the Germans now had no choice. Yeah. Yes. This is the system of the Paris Accords. It's I'm up here to number 3A. That's half of the Paris Accords, these military constraints. Right? Germany does not have freedom of action, can't pose a threat to the Soviets. Right? Germany's locked into dependence on the Western powers. All very important. Whereas Germany's also being protected. But that's not the end of it. It also has a political side. The occupation statute is ended. Germany is no longer an occupied country. But this does not mean that Germany has full sovereignty. There are major limits on German sovereignty that are carried over from the earlier limits that had been imposed on Germany in the occupation statute. These are called the reserved rights, sometimes called the reserved powers, exercised by the three Western powers, United States, Britain, and France. They had the right, according to the Paris Accords, to station troops on German territory. What this meant is the Germans couldn't just kick them out. Right? The Germans couldn't, on their own, negotiate some sort of agreement with the Soviets providing for the neutralization of their country as part of a reunification deal. The Western powers had the right to block that and, in fact, to refuse to go along with it because they had the right to station troops in German territory. Not only that, that they had the right to use those troops for military action against the Soviets without first getting the okay of the German authorities. Right? And they also had the right, under in extreme circumstances, if a kind of neo-Nazi group or a communist group was threatening to take over the German government, to intervene in German domestic politics. These are major constraints on German sovereignty. Right. But the Paris Accords are ratified. The Germans begin constructing an army in 1955. Germany becomes part of NATO in 1955. Okay? And the whole question here is, could this have served as a basis for a viable political system? Could the East and the West coexist on this basis? For this system to work, you would have needed three countries to go along with it, basically. Three most important countries. Germany, Soviet Union, and the United States. We'll begin with the Soviet Union. I'll reverse the discussion. The Soviets would have gone along with this if they could believe that it was viable, because it solved the number one security problem in Europe. The problem of resurgence of German power. Why is that a problem? Because the Germans are revisionists. They're not happy with the division of Europe. They're not happy with the fact they've lost half of their pre-war territory to the communists. They're not happy with the fact that, you know, like something like 20 million of their compatriots have to live under communist rule in East Germany. Right? If they're strong, and that means becoming a nuclear power, then that would create problems for the Soviets. Germans could intervene in the event of an uprising in East Germany or whatever. Soviets, there's a great fear of the Soviets, a German nuclear capability, a strong, freestanding West German state. The Paris Accords alleviate those fears because they make Germany dependent on powers that pursue a much more conservative policy, a policy of accepting the status quo of a divided Europe. Yeah. Germans might not like it, but they have no choice. So Soviets, if they believed in the Paris Accord system, if they thought it was a viable system and that it could last and that everyone else would go along with it, they could live with these kind of arrangements. Well, what about the Germans? Would they accept it? It solved their number one security problem, the problem of defense against the Soviet Union. The strongest country in the world, the United States, was protecting them. They were part of the Western system. They had been taken back into the Western world as a form of political, moral rehabilitation, if you will. Standing shoulder to shoulder with the other Western powers in defense of Western civilization. The limitations on German power, well, that could be accepted because it was a fundamental part of the German political creed at that point that the Federal Republic was just a temporary state. It was that the division of Germany was not final, that the states that had come into being were just provisional in nature. And so they wanted their existing status to be limited. They wanted a kind of continuation, in a sense, of the post-war regime because it implied that there had been no final, definitive solution to the German problem. Two sovereign German states, that would have meant it was, you know, the German problem had been settled for good. So all these kind of limits on German power served a certain political purpose. Maintaining the occupation regime was also important because the status of West Berlin was important to the West Germans, and the existence of West Berlin under the military protection of the three Western powers was part of the occupation regime. You don't want to liquidate that entirely if you care about the defense of Berlin. There are all these kind of legal arguments that are made. There are political arguments. Adenauer himself, very committed to the West, you know, didn't like the idea of, you know, wasn't too keen, put it that way, about the idea of unification. In any case, a Germany dependent on the West, integrated into the West, would take on the coloration of the Western world, would become a much more Western country. No longer any of this talk about Germany is as having its own special way of doing things, the German Sonderweg, this is called. You know, Germany would become a Western country, a civilized country. This is essential to kind of, you know, put the whole Nazi past behind the country. The Germans, in the final analysis, yeah, the Germans would have gone along with it too. But what about the Americans? It turned out that I'll get you in a sec. It turned out that the American attitude was the real problem. The Americans would have had to go along with this, but the Eisenhower administration had only accepted these arrangements grudgingly. They didn't like this, the whole notion of America, you know, being stuck in Europe, having to defend Europe. These Europeans, they're strong enough to defend themselves. Economic resources as such, the human resources, technological capability as such, that they're capable of providing on their own an effective counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. They should want to stand on their own two feet. They shouldn't want to become an American protectorate. We don't think it's a healthy sort of relationship for them to be kind of kept down and for America to have all the power. So it was the Eisenhower policy based on the most admirable aspirations that meant that this NATO system, the 1954 system, the system established by the Paris Accords, would not be the basis of a viable political order in Europe. And in fact, within the space of a few years, you find troubles developing again. A new crisis breaks out. In November of 1958, over Berlin. And the Berlin crisis, of which the Cuban Missile Crisis was a part, lasts until October of 1962, right? That crisis proves that the 1954 arrangements had not laid the basis of a stable international order. And so the world was going to have to go through another great period of crisis before a stable system took shape. And that's what I'm going to talk about next time. But before you break up, she had a question. Okay.